I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, we feature two imaginative and inspired writers of books for young readers. In the first half of the hour, our guest is San Francisco-raised, best-selling graphic novelist Raina Telgemeier. She's joined in conversation by NPR's Guy Raz. Then, in the second half of the hour, our guest is actor, comedian, screenwriter, and director BJ Novak, who is best known for his work on the hit television show The Office. Most recently, Novak has added children's book author to his long list of talents. But now, let's join Guy Raz on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Raina Telgemeier.
Well, welcome, everybody. It's so wonderful to see so many of you and so many kids, so many teens and kids and folks in the audience. It's really awesome and so exciting to be here with Raina Telgemeier. How exciting is it to see Raina Telgemeier in person? So we're going to do something. I don't know if kids in the audience know a show I do called How I Built This, but some of the grown-ups might. And what I do on that show is I talk about people's lives, like, you know, from the very beginning to where they are now. So we're going to do a little bit of that with Raina. Some of you might know her story, but some of you might not. So I thought we would start here in San Francisco. This is actually where you grew up. This is your hometown.
I was born across the street at the Kaiser on Geary. Yeah. I'm like 0.03 miles away from my birthplace. Yeah.
Wow. And of course, we know some of your childhood from your books, about your childhood from your books. But you grew up here in San Francisco. And what was it like as a kid here in the city in the, you know, at that time, the 80s? And
I mean, it was the late 70s, early 80s when I was a kid. So it was like the days of free love and, you know, understanding, and everybody was in a very, like, peaceful space, but it was also, like, war was brewing overseas, and I didn't really know that much about it, so it was this clashing of, like, hippie happiness plus, like, foreboding, you know, the world might end soon. Yeah. And in the midst of all that, I went to Lakeshore Elementary School. Any takers in the audience? I can't see you guys, so I'm going to assume that some of you know where that is. And I grew up in Park Merced, which is over by San Francisco State. And so that was my part of the city, right by the ocean, right by the beach, right where the fog never leaves. And so there is something that happens when you grow up in the fog, which is that there are no seasons. Mm-hmm. The seasons never change. And so when I started making books about my childhood, one of the notes that I got from my editor was, Raina, it's really hard to tell, like, the passage of time. How much time has passed between the first part of the story and the middle and the end or whatever. And I was like, San Francisco, that's that's how it felt. But I've always been pretty good at, like, marking my life with stories and with events that have happened to me. And my parents were fortunately really good with taking photographs. Mm. And they were also great about keeping a lot of the art that I did when I was a kid. So I do have these little, like, physical touchstones that I can look back on and say, oh, that must have happened when I was about 5 years old. Or, oh, we went to this, you know, camping trip when I was seven. And so I've had a pretty good way to look back on my life.
We have obviously a window into what you were like as a kid, some of a window from some of your books. Tell us a little bit more about what you were like as a kid. Were you gregarious? Were you outgoing? Was it easy for you to make friends? Were you sometimes introverted and lonely?
I think I was all of the above.
Huh.
And so you've heard of introverts, which are the people that recharge kind of on their own, doing quiet things, and extroverts who get their energy from being around other people. And I think I'm an ambivert, which is right in the center.
Uh-huh.
I'm also a Gemini, so I think I've just always had two personalities. But I needed both. I needed to have a group of friends, and I had quite a lot of friends when I was growing up. It was nice. I lived in a community with lots of, like, backyards and a lot of neighborhood kids, and then I had my friends at school. But every day I had to draw, and for me, drawing is a pretty solitary activity.
When did you start doing that?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't remember. It was that long ago. But
you
like
just always drew?
I think so.
From the time, like, always from when you were a little kid.
Did you draw when you were a kid?
Always doodled, and I still doodle. I'm doodling on this piece of paper right now.
Oh, cool.
But did you, I mean, that was just something you did. It was drawing. It wasn't like sort of abstract painting or anything like that.
It was pretty abstract when I was one.
Okay.
here's an orange crayon. Here's a green crayon. But, yeah, I mean, my mom and dad saved all of those drawings. And so you can sort of see the progression between scribbles. And then I must have been watching cartoons on TV because you can start to see them turn into shapes that look more like humanoid characters. And then just kind of it progressed as I went. But I don't remember a time before I started drawing. I always remember it was just something that I liked to do. And so as like a elementary school, middle school kid, it sort of became my identity. What are you? Who are you? Rain is the artist.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of classified early on in my career as a child by
being... You were the artist. What was your sister?
She was also the artist.
She was the artist.
Yeah, so that created a little tension. Because my sister is 5 years younger than I am, and that meant that she had a role model. She had somebody who was already doing something she liked to do, and we did it together. And I think the second kid benefits from that. They just they have somebody older that they can kind of... latch onto what they're doing. And so her drawings were way better than mine. So when she was 2 and I was 7, her drawings were as good as mine had been when I was 5.
Wow.
And she started like winning contests and contests that I had gotten like honorable mention in. My sister would win first place and she'd get a free trip to Great America.
Wow. I do not remember this in sisters, actually.
No, that's not the whole story.
Okay, yeah.
And that's true of all my books. I mean, I put relevant stories into my books.
Yeah.
So if I'm telling a story about my teeth, most of the details that go into that story itself are about my teeth. And my new book, Guts, which comes out in September, is going to focus more on, well, I don't know, am I spoiling it by talking
about
it now?
Yeah, we'll talk about it, but it's okay. You can
okay.
Mention, yeah.
Well, it's about fear. It's about anxiety. It's about food. It's about phobias. It's about a lot of stuff that I know some kids are going to be able to relate to. And so I tell the story of, like, my family's food preferences and how we were really picky and, like, the kinds of things we like to eat for dinner. And so you won't see that in my other books because it wasn't part of that story.
Right.
But there are always little callbacks, and I think that overall I'm sort of telling this larger and richer picture of the more books that I do.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have done that starting out.
So as a kid, you are already sort of identified and self-identify as an artist from an early age. You show talent. You're not as talented as your sister Mara.
No.
But you're showing some talent. And by the time you got to like middle school, Was it something you did every day? Like, did you have a space in your room where you... Can you describe what your art space in your room was like?
Yeah, it was a desk with a light on it.
Oh, wow. Well,
and I think it had a drawer on the side. Like, it wasn't fancy at all.
But you had, like...
I did.
Big pieces of paper.
Yeah, we always had...
Colored pencils? Or?
Oh, yes. Colored pencils, crayons. I was very fond of markers when I was in middle school and high school. But... I started making comics when I was 10.
Wow.
I started reading them at 9, and I started making my own at 10. So I sort of left everything else behind once I found comics. I had been doing, you know, like illustrations and big displays and posters, and my art was all over the place. I just drew whatever I wanted to. But as soon as I discovered comics, I started telling specifically stories about characters who looked a lot like me and my family, a lot like me and my friends. One of my favorite comic strips is For Better or For Worse by Lynn Johnston.
Yeah.
And that was a slice of life humor strip about a family. And it just became my number one like inspiration and kind of guidepost. And I started, you know, tracing her art and copying her art and trying to make my characters look like hers. And what she did was just do, you know, small moments and interactions between the family members. So my comic strips look just like that.
I love that as an influence because so many... comic writers refer to Calvin and Hobbes.
I'm not, yes,
right?
Me too.
Always Calvin, which is a great comic, but for better or worse, that's more obscure, but you can see the connection. A lot of kids here might not know that comic, but it really was that kind of iconic strip in that way.
Yes, and the most unique thing about For Better or For Worse is it started in 1979 and it went for 29 years, and the characters all grew up in real time. during those 29 years. Mm. So Michael and Elizabeth, who were the children in that family, were the same age as me and my sister. So it was like we grew up together. Mm. And it was like they were my next door neighbors. And I felt like I knew them so personally because I got to get inside of their heads and know their thoughts. So, I mean, I didn't intentionally model my work after Lynn's, but I think it's a very clear connection when you look at them side by side. Mm. And so I was making comic strips as a, you know, fifth grader, sixth grader, but I was also writing in a diary every day. And it wasn't long before I started illustrating the entries in my
diary.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I never showed them to anybody. But, I mean, I did it for 20 years, and it was amazing daily practice. And that is what I do.
You know, by the way, this is just as an aside. A lot of people, I'm sure, ask you, Raina, how do I become a good artist or how do I become a good storyteller? That's the way to do it. It's like, how do I become an NBA player? You stand at the free throw line and you throw 20,000 baskets and you miss most of them until you start making them.
Yeah.
That's how you become an author illustrator.
But most people don't say, can we see those 20,000 baskets? Can you show them to us?
Right.
Did you give them all on video to see like how horrible you were as a basketball player?
Right.
When you're an artist, you have physical proof of how bad you were.
Yeah.
So I plan to show it all at some point.
But you have to go, right? This is important. You
it
have
is.
To go through a phase where you're bad at it for a long time before you get good at it.
And that's true. I don't know if it's helpful to tell yourself that you're bad at it. I think that you might think that, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't show it to other people.
Right,
I think it's still okay to share. It's still okay to say, like, I'm practicing. I'm working on this. I'm trying to get better. And the more you do, the better you get.
Mm.
But I think we do have a tendency to look at what we are doing and say this isn't good enough.
Yeah.
But for me, I was doing it because I loved it, not because I thought it was good or bad. And I was interested enough in the craft of comics to try and understand them better and to try to apply what I was learning. There's a really, really good book called Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it would hit everybody at 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, the way that it hit me at like age 16. But that's when I read that book. And it just blew my mind with how much nuts and bolts, nitty gritty stuff there is to learn about the medium. And I've always kind of been fascinated about what goes on behind the scenes with making comics as well as just making them.
So you, obviously, you're in high school. You go off to art school.
Yeah.
It was clear at that point that this was going to be this is the thing you were going to do? You were going to become an artist?
I hoped so.
You hoped so.
The problem was, so I graduated from Lowell High School in 1995, and then didn't go to art school until 1999. I had 4 years in between, and I went to the City College of San Francisco in that time. I'm just dropping names here. That's really what Aptus Middle School. I didn't mention that one. That's what being in San Francisco is all about.
Yep.
So in those 4 years in between high school and college, I had a chance to kind of figure out what I wanted to do, and I had a really, really awesome drawing teacher at CCSF, and I wasn't sure, like, what format, what direction I was going to go in. And part of the problem was, yes, I knew I wanted to be a cartoonist, but at the time, the only real channels available were to work for Marvel in DC and make superhero comic books, or to be a comic strip artist like Calvin and Hobbes, for better or for worse.
Right.
And neither of those two things were quite right. If somebody had told me, you can basically make long-form diary comics that are going to be printed and as books and like sold in bookstores and book fairs, I would have said, well, that's the job for me. I'm not even going to try anything else.
But that whole genre didn't exist.
No. My publisher didn't start publishing comics until 2005.
Yeah.
So I had to figure it out. And what I did in the meantime was just to self-publish. I just printed my own stuff and just kind of put it out there. That means I put stuff up on the web. I made mini comics and took them to art shows and I sold stuff on my website. Like, I was just like, I know I want to do this, but I don't know how.
So writing a comic strip wasn't the thing that you felt was right for you. That wasn't the story you wanted to tell. And you didn't want to do Marvel Comics.
Right.
You wanted to do something in between or maybe beyond that, which was taking the comic strip concept but turning it into a story that didn't have to have a punchline or a joke. But that was the story.
That was really important.
And there was nothing like that. Do you remember when you first saw something like that and you thought, wait a minute, This is what I want to do. Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, it was Bone by Jeff Smith.
Huh.
And he was a self-publisher. He was publishing Bone himself starting in the early 90s, and he just kept doing it every month. And then eventually Scholastic was the publisher of Bone. They reprinted Bone as a full-color graphic novel series. And I think the first time I read Bone, it was as a graphic novel. Mm. Like, it was bound into a book, and I had about, 10 people tell me before I read it, you're going to love this, you're going to read this, you need to read this book. And I was like, nah, whatever. And then when I finally did, I was like, whoops, they were right. Sometimes your friends know more about you than you know about yourself. But that was true with Bone. And it was just something about that format, that there was space. There was space mm-hmm. for quiet moments. There was space for action. There was space for humor. There was space for, really like developed relationships and also beautiful artwork. If you guys haven't read Bone by Jeff Smith, it's so, so beautiful to look at. So that lit a light bulb in my head that I'm very grateful for.
Yeah.
And by the time I got out of school, I was ready to go, but I didn't have a publisher yet. I was just kind of free form.
Yeah. And for a long time, and you were sort of, as you alluded to, you self-published, you mm-hmm. put things up on the web. I mean, Smile began as a weekly panel, right?
That's right.
It was just one panel.
It was one page every week.
One page every week.
Yeah.
And you just put it online.
Yep.
And it was just a thing you did, and mm-hmm. no one was paying you for it.
No.
So how did that thing that you started out as just a fun project, how did that then get to Scholastic Graphics, their imprint, to become a book?
So I started Smile in 2004. And it was on this website called girlomatic.com, which was girl-friendly comics. And at the time, that was a big deal. And at the same time, my mini comics had gotten the attention of the people at Scholastic who were just starting up the graphics imprint. So they asked me to work with them, but Smile was in its infancy, and so they ended up publishing the Babysitter's Club graphic novels.
Right.
So that was my first published project.
That was your first book, The Babysitter,
yes.
Right.
And so those books were published from 2006 to... talking too quickly and getting so excited. 2008, diction. And then after that, the recession happened and some other stuff happened. And so I wasn't sure what was going to come next. But all that while, I had been putting up pages of Smile. One a week, the story grew, people started to get interested in it.
Yeah.
And Scholastic said, okay, well, let's take a chance and let's put out your book.
So, and that was it.
That was it.
So that was it. You put this book out in 2008. I think around that time, or maybe in the years just preceding that, you still had a day job. You were working at as an editorial assistant at a publishing company in New York?
I was, yeah. I worked for a publisher called Stuart DeBory and Chang. They are the sister company to Abrams, who is now like a big publisher. They're the publishers of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series and El Defo by C.C. Bell and like a bunch of other cool...
But that was your day job. That was to pay your rent, drawing cartoons. That was your passion at night.
I was busy pretty much full time. I would go to work for 8 hours, and then come home and make comics until I crashed.
Wow.
And I didn't have an air conditioner either. So in the summer times, this was in New York City, like it was really hot. And so I would sometimes sleep for like 4 or 5 hours and then just be like, I'm just going to go to the office now really, really early because they have air conditioning.
So. Yeah. So Smile is published in
2010. Yeah.
And it's a rocket. It's a total, no, yes, right?
Yeah.
It's a rocket. It's a phenomenon.
Wait, pause. It was kind of a rocket.
Okay.
I'll tell you why. Because it came out and the initial book fair's orders was big. So kids had access to Smile at the school. They would go to their book fairs. They would be like, oh, this cool comic thing. I've never seen anything like it. Okay. So kids' word of mouth was strong from the get-go. Took grown-ups a while to catch up. So you could go into a comic store, you could go into a bookstore and be like, hey, do you have a copy of Smile? And they'd be like, what is that? Is that like some self-help adult nonfiction book? It wasn't for another year and a half until it hit the New York Times bestseller list.
Wow.
Year and a half.
But then it never left.
It never left. No, it left when they canceled the comics part of the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Because they were like, boy, Raina's just been on this thing
forever. Raina's at the top.
I had 8 books out by the time they canceled it. So
God.
It would be like 8 bestsellers and then like 2 other people that would... sorry, other people.
And And it's followed then, of course, by Sisters and Drama and other books in between. And, mm-hmm. and we'll get to some of that when we get Q&A here, because I'd love to hear from the kids in this audience, both the boys and the girls, and anyone in the audience about what it is about Raina's work that speaks to them, because there's something very visceral. As you know, I have two boys. Raina came to our Hanukkah party last year, and she came in, and no one knew who she was, and I happened to whisper to a couple of kids, "That's Raina Telgemeier," and she was mobbed. 30 kids mobbed Raina in my kitchen and didn't let her leave for 2 hours.
I get to eat brisket, though.
You did get to eat brisket.
That was pretty fun.
Kids were, like, almost crying. They were so happy to talk to you, my kids. And so there's something about those books that just spoke to kids, and it really did create this boom in graphic novels for kids. And a lot of that credit goes to you.
You're listening to best-selling graphic novelist Raina Telgemeier, whose book is Share Your Smile, Raina's Guide to Telling Your Own Story. She's joined in conversation by Guy Raz on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I mean, the work that I do is... it's pretty introspective. It's about reaching really deep inside to find those crunchy memories and those sticky ones that have something to them that I want to talk about. It can be draining.
Yeah.
It can be exhausting to have to do that over and over again. And so after I've finished a book, I feel like I weigh 50 pounds less than I did when I started. I feel amazing.
Yeah.
It's like I've closed that book. I've closed that chapter of my life, and now I can move on and think about other stuff. And then I go on stage and everybody wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
So what was it really like when you lost those two front teeth of yours?
Right.
And
right.
then I have to live it all over again.
Right.
But you get better at that the more you do it. And I really enjoy being able to connect with readers because they're seeing that experience for the first time. They might be seeing something that reflects their own life.
Yeah.
For the first time. And it's really powerful.
You know, I'm sure a lot of kids in this audience, they read those books and they say, that's me. That's my story. Like my son read Sisters and he said, that's me and my brother.
That's so right? cool.
And I'm sure some of the boys in here have similar stories. What you may not know is that once you get to our age, your memory shrinks. You don't remember things as much as you do when you're a kid. And so what's remarkable about your books is the rich detail and the memories. How do you trigger your memories? How do you bring them back? What are some of the things you do to remember those moments that you can write about and illustrate?
Like I said, I'm lucky that I have access to my old artwork and to old photos and books that I read when I was younger, songs that I was a fan of, movies that I liked. All I have to do is put one on and it's like it all comes rushing back.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll do that. I'll dig into Spotify and just punch in, like, you know, 1986 or something and see what comes back to me. And a lot of times it's stuff that I've already sort of put through the wheels, but sometimes it surprises me. And I feel like anybody can do that, but I've gotten pretty good at it. I've just sort of been flexing this muscle for a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, digging back, you know, when you dig back into those moments and you realize... you know, when you're a kid, you have these moments of anxiety and fear that you now see and understand better and why they may not have been rational or you can understand them better and more intensely. And you really capture that. And in this, now I think is a chance to talk about this book,
yeah.
about Guts coming out
oh,
in the fall,
goodness.
Which in some ways is your most personal book, right?
It is. And that's saying something because all of my books have been my most personal
yeah.
book. But it's about stuff I've not been able to talk about until now. And I think just to kind of go back to something you were talking about before, I feel like it's really important when I am writing my books to not let my current voice slip in too much.
Huh.
So that's one thing I do, is I try to keep my own opinion out of it. I try to just remember what 10-year-old, 12-year-old, 14-year-old
almost like felt. An out-of-body experience. You're looking at Raina. You're just the reporter taking
yeah.
notes.
And sometimes it's just a matter of, like, the type of writing I'm doing. So Just like as far as narrative goes, if you've read Smile, there is a narrator. There are caption boxes that say things like, the next day, or I was feeling really worried in that moment. But in Sisters, I decided to try telling a story without the captions. Mm. So there's no narrator in Sisters. Mm. And I think that makes the two works feel a little bit different. But I went back to narration for Guts because I felt like it was important to sort of contextualize the things that I went to. And specifically what I went through was I started having panic attacks when I was 9 years old, and I started seeing a therapist and was pretty ashamed of that and didn't want to talk to people about it. Mm. I don't know if it was the time in our culture that it was a little bit more
taboo.
People
just didn't talk about it.
People didn't talk about it as much as they do now, and I think we're really lucky. But so I sat down and just wrote the script. I wrote the script from my own head and my own memories and just put down everything that I could remember onto the page. But then we had a therapist read it and say, well, this is what a therapist might have said in the 80s, but this is how they would say the same thing now.
Yeah.
So we don't want to confuse the reader. I want my reader to have a pretty, you know, close experience with reading this story. So whether it's my full memory talking or my memory that's been altered a little bit by like adults and being an adult and talking with adults now.
Right.
So people often ask, like, what percentage of your book is true? And I say it's probably about 90-10. Hmm. Like, the story is true. Everything that happens in the story is true. But there is maybe 10% of, like, the adult author who's contextualizing stuff that goes into the final product. But I don't want you to know that when you're reading it. I don't want you to feel that when you're reading it. I want you to feel like you're there. You're in it. So,
Well, we are also here to talk about a new project that you have. And I know a lot of you guys have this book out in your hands. Share Your Smile.
Yeah.
This is an interactive guide for kids to help them tell their own stories.
Yeah.
It's a way to kind of help kids become, you, or if they want to become you. Tell us about this book and how that came about.
So it kind of came from just these events that I do and these Q&As that I do. And I get a lot of fan mail. And one of the things people always want to know is, where do you begin?
Mm.
How do you make comics? How do you get better at making comics?
Yeah.
And what are the things that you've done in your life to become who you are? And so this book is about demystifying the process a little bit and just goes into my thought process. How do I come up with ideas and how do I take real life events and turn them into stories? How do I world build? And so it's just about, like, kind of looking at the world around you and then writing things down and using what you've written down to create a story. Whether it's true with, like, some fantasy, whether it's totally true, whether you decide to make your characters animals, but they have the same name as you and your mm-hmm. friends. That's not important. It's more about what you want to do. And so this was just a way to show people and also tell.
Hmm.
And I think that's what cartoonists do the best, is I could tell you how to be a cartoonist, but I can also show you and I can give you some templates and some pages to practice on. And do you want to ask a couple more questions? Do you want to see if the audience has
I'm really curious to hear from these guys.
Yeah,
Raina.
Me too.
Let's start with some questions. And this is right here for Raina. Yes.
You talked a little bit about the sort of boom in these graphic novels about, I sort of describe them as like middle grade girls with social problems. But one of the things that I love about these books is that they take the emotional lives of 8, 9, and 10-year-old girls with such care and sensitivity and thoughtfulness. And I'm interested in whether you see that as part of your legacy, or, you know, when you think of your own work, do you think of it as the art that is the groundbreaker, or is it the art plus the emotional realism?
I think it's both, and that's what's cool about comics is you really can't separate the writing from the art, and sometimes people try it. Sometimes you've got a comic where one person's doing the writing and another person's doing the art, and that's a whole other, like, interesting thing to talk about, but since I do the two, they're so closely connected, I actually can't separate them. And when I write my comics, this is what they look like. There are words and pictures when they come out of my head and onto the page. It's seamless for me. And I try to write prose, and I'm peppering it with emojis the whole way through. And most of my drawings have at least two pictures. Like, a sequence is more comfortable for me. So, I mean, thank you. That's a really wonderful thing for you to say. I'm super flattered, and I take that role really seriously. I think that it's probably the introspective writing, respecting of children's feelings and the way that humans relate to each other. But I think the art brings it to the reader in a whole different way. So I think being able to see how a character is feeling, as well as reading what's going on in their head, and then picturing yourself in that character's shoes and how you might respond. And then a lot of kids will take that and they'll go and make their own comics. So it's just like, it just taps into your insides in a way that I can't really think of another medium that does that so well. And I'm amazed that I get to do this for a living, and I love it so much, and I'm so happy that you guys are all here tonight and that you like to read and you want to make stuff and share your smile. Yeah. Wow.
In many of your stories, how did you remember your friends like you did?
Yeah, how did you remember your friends in a lot of your stories and the things they said and the way they acted?
You don't forget when they're mean to you.
Yeah.
So that's both a good thing and a bad thing. But I don't know. I have a pretty visual memory. I have a lot of memories that are rooted in an image. And I think that's something a lot of cartoonists like to talk about is the image. There's just this one image in your head and you can't get rid of it. And for the start of Smile, when me and my friends are running home from a Girl Scout meeting and I trip and fall and knock out my two front teeth, I just could not stop thinking about Kelly's pink sweatshirt. She had this pink sweatshirt on, and that was the thing where she was ahead of me, and I chased after her a little bit, and I grabbed my body, reached forward to grab her hood, and then for some reason, the stumble happened, and I pitched forward and knocked my two front teeth against the pavement. Yeah. But I remember that visual so clearly, that image of her pink sweatshirt. I don't remember the sweatshirt I was wearing because it was covered in blood, and it was really sad. But then the first thought that went through my head was, how are my hands? Are my hands okay? Because my hands are my most important tool. I'm an artist. I'm a creator, and I draw. And so at 11 years old, to trip and have an accident, and the first thought that goes through your head is, are my hands okay? You never forget that.
Right.
And so I'm like, oh, my hands are fine. Cool. Great. Oh, wait a second. Something else is wrong. So I build stories off of memories like those, and I do not remember exactly what my mom and dad would have said right after it happened, but I know my parents. I know them well. So I know the kinds of things that they would have said. And so that's really how it works, is I just sort of start with something very specific, and then I build around it the best that I can do.
So say you were to have a child that is an aspiring artist, and what things would you encourage parents to do for their children to help continue to push them in that path?
So, my parents got me a lot of art supplies. I remember going to art classes. I took an art class at the De Young Museum. My parents found this lady who was a painting teacher, and she did Saturday art classes in her garage. I wish that there had been more authors that I could have seen when I was a kid. I wish I could have come to something like this and met an author and been able to have a dialogue with them. I think that would have been super cool. So thank you, parents, for bringing your kids tonight. I was given how to make art books, and there are a lot of those out there, but time, that's the biggest gift you can give your kids. Let them be bored.
Yeah.
Don't take them to every single thing that's available.
You don't need to be on a screen all the time.
That's
I know your
true.
Parents say that. By the way, if you get bored because you don't get screen time, just read one of Raina's books or listen to Wow in the World. All right, Raina, last question for me. You are in this audience. Let's say you were in this audience and you were 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 or 12, and you're watching your hero, and it's a different author, but you're in there, young Raina Tuggemeier. What do you wish you knew when you were a kid that you now know that makes it all easier?
I mean, my heart started pounding when you asked me this question. No one's ever asked me that before, but that's really good. I just would have liked someone to give me the confidence that they came from wherever they came from. They were also a kid who liked to draw. They were a kid who had ideas for stories, even if they didn't think they could get published. And somehow they got here on this stage. Just like the reassurance that if you stick with something, if you want something badly enough and do it often enough, you too can be here. So that's not really a question, but that like one-to-one connection between somebody who's a little bit older that says, you too can do this, would have meant the world to me.
Yeah.
So.
That's great advice.
Yeah.
Hey, friends, Raina Telgemeier. How awesome is she? Right? All right.
Thanks, Guy. Thank you. Great. Thank you. That was really nice.
You've been listening to best-selling graphic novelist Raina Telgemeier, whose book is Share Your Smile, Raina's Guide to Telling Your Own Story. She was joined in conversation by Guy Raz. For the second half of our program, our guest is actor, comedian, screenwriter, and director BJ Novak, best known for his work on the hit television show The Office. His recent book for children, and for readers of books to children, is The Book with No Pictures. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce BJ Novak.
All right. On to BJ Novak and his new book, The Book with No Pictures, an instant bestseller. I'm going to let BJ tell you all about the book and why he decided to write it himself, but I will tell you that every person I've read the book to this past week has laughed so hard they almost stopped breathing. They looked at me like I was the greatest comedy genius to ever live. So thanks to BJ for that. As you probably know, BJ is an actor, writer, or was an actor, writer, and director, and executive producer on NBC's Emmy Award-winning comedy series, The Office. He is also acclaimed for his stand-up comedy, his performances in movies, and his first book, the New York Times bestseller, One More Thing. We are so thrilled to host him, and without further ado, please join me in welcoming BJ Novak.
Hello. Thank you all so much for coming. Hello to all the kids. My name is BJ Novak, and I have two jobs. I am an actor and a writer. And for any kids that, I think most kids know what those jobs are, but I'll give you an example of something that I did for kids that they might know as an actor that Jordan didn't introduce. Has any kid heard of a movie called The Smurfs? Okay, some of you. So I was in a movie called The Smurfs. Now, of course, The Smurfs are drawn, they're animated, and they're blue. They're not real people, but they needed real people to do the voices when things happened to the Smurfs. So my job as an actor was to be Baker Smurf. Does anyone remember Baker Smurf? He has a hat and he's always baking. You remember. So at one point in the movie, Baker Smurf just baked a tray of muffins, and Clumsy Smurf comes and bangs right into him, and all the muffins go flying in the air. And they needed an actor to make the voice of Baker Smurf. So they put me in front of a microphone, and I went like this. Whoa! My muffins! And that was my job as an actor. So I tell you that for a couple reasons. One is to introduce myself with something that maybe some of you saw as kids. And another is to tell you that I love making kids laugh. And because my other job is as a writer, and when you're a writer, you can write anything you want. As long as you can write the words on a piece of paper, you're allowed to write it. No one can stop you. So with that freedom in mind, I thought, if I could write anything, what would I write? And I thought it'd be great to write a book that really made kids laugh. So that's what I decided to do. And I wrote a book called The Book with No Pictures. So I'm going to read you The Book with No Pictures. I hope you like it. And then I'm going to answer questions from kids first about The Book with No Pictures, and then grown-ups can too. So let me explain to you The Book with No Pictures. And the first thing I should show you is that there's a warning on the back that explains the book for grown-ups. And this says, warning, this book looks serious, but it is actually completely ridiculous. If a kid is trying to make you read this book, the kid is playing a trick on you. You will end up saying silly things and making everybody laugh and laugh. Don't say I didn't warn you. So that's the warning on the back. But if you hand this book to a grown-up, you don't have to show them the warning. You can just hand it like that, and they won't see it. I just thought it was fair to put the warning.
You're listening to actor, comedian, screenwriter, and director BJ Novak, whose children's book is The Book with No Pictures, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I'm going to read the book, and I hope kids enjoy it. And here you go. This is The Book with No Pictures. The Book with No Pictures by BJ Novak. That's me. This is a book with no pictures. It might seem like no fun to have someone read you a book with no pictures. Right? Who would do that? It probably seems boring and serious. Except, here is how books work. Everything the words say, the person reading the book has to say. No matter what. That's the deal. That's the rule. So that means, even if the words say, blork. Wait, what? That doesn't even mean anything. Blurf? Wait a second. What? This isn't the kind of book I wanted to read. And I have to say every word the book says? Uh-oh. I am a monkey who taught myself to read. Hey, I'm not a monkey! And now I am reading you this book with my monkey mouth in my monkey voice. That's not true! I'm not a monkey! Yes, I am a monkey. Also, I am a robot monkey. What? And my head is made of blueberry pizza. Wait a second. Is this whole book a trick? Can I stop reading, please? No. Okay. And now it's time for me to sing you my favorite song. A song? Do I really have to sing a... Glug, 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 my face is a bug. I eat ants for breakfast right off the rug. What? This book is ridiculous. Can I stop reading yet? No, there are more pages. I have to read the rest. My only friend in the whole wide world is a hippo named Boo Boo Butt. Boo Boo Butt. And also, the kids I'm reading this book to are the best kids ever in the history of the entire world. Oh, really? And these kids are the smartest kids, too, because these kids chose this book even though it had no pictures. Because kids know this is the book that makes grown-ups have to say silly things. And make silly sounds like... Oh, no. Oh, no. Here it comes. Waco McGrumfudu, aye, 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 brook, 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 oomph, eemph, blaggity, blaggity, glibbity, globbity, globbity, glibbity, beep, boop, eeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeeee Oh my goodness. Please don't ever make me read this book again. It is so silly. In fact, it is completely... it is completely and utterly preposterous. Next time, please, 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 please choose a book with pictures. Please. Because this is just too ridiculous to read. The end. Bonk. I didn't want to say that. Thank you guys very much. That is the book with no pictures, and every copy of the book is exactly like that. So if you ever hand this to a parent, a teacher, an older brother or sister, a babysitter, they will all have to read the exact same words. And it's funny when different people read it. So I would love to answer any kid's questions or respond to any kid's comments who would like to say something or ask me a question about the book with no pictures. And I would love you to come right up to the microphone so people can hear you. Would any kid like to come up and ask a question? Sure. Yeah.
Why did you want to write a book with no pictures?
Why did I want to write a book with no pictures? Great question. Well, the first book I wrote had no pictures, to be fair, but it was for grown-ups. And most books for grown-ups have no pictures. But my first idea was I was reading a book to my best friend's son, who was only two. But when he handed me the book, something occurred to me, which is, this is kind of funny because this two-year-old can't read, but I have to read whatever is in the book he gives me. So he has a lot of power over me that he probably doesn't realize or realizes it without thinking about it. And that's kind of funny that a two-year-old would have power over a grown-up. And if anyone knows sort of on a more sophisticated level the film business, it's sort of or has ever acted in a play, it's sort of like he's giving me a script and I have to say the lines that he's saying. It's sort of like I'm for hire, and he's like a little Harvey Weinstein, if anyone knows that reference. So I thought, well, this is very funny, and what's his dream that would make use of this funny power dynamic? And I thought, well, the funniest thing would probably be if a grown-up had to say words that he didn't want to say at all, and the kid would feel like an evil genius by choosing this book and realize that words have so much power. Then I thought, well, what would the pictures be? Because kids' books always have pictures. And then I thought, you know what? I can't even imagine what the pictures would be. What if I didn't have any pictures? And I called it The Book with No Pictures. And then I emphasized sort of the whole magic and the whole lesson of the book, which is that words can make you do anything, and they have so much power. So then I thought, if I called it The Book with No Pictures, it would be so intriguing to kids that had only usually seen books with pictures that would inspire a lot of curiosity, and the kids would want to know what's in it. And then when they realized this book was so silly, when it looked so serious, it would add a whole extra interesting level of surprise. So thank you very much for that question. It allowed me to say a lot of things that I wanted to say about the book.
The next question is over here.
Hi, did you ever consider not breaking the fourth wall in your book, like keeping
it
in the
world? Where do you go to school? Send your kids to this guy's school. What year are you?
Seventh grade.
Seventh grade, not break the fourth wall. All right, I was too distracted by your intelligence. Please ask again.
Is there ever a time when you decide to, like, keep it in that world and not break the fourth wall and, like, oh, sorry.
Sure. Well, I think this, the original concept of this book was always sort of a fourth wall breaking, a meta book, if you will. Meta sort of meaning something that comments on itself and sort of has its own conceptual... Are you following? I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
You're with me. So in terms of that, I did always envision this as that kind of book. And I think sort of the key to... The reason that breaking the fourth wall was so important in this book rather than just saying silly things without commenting on them is that one thing that I learned from my work on the TV show The Office is that it's usually the reaction shot to the funny thing that actually gets the laugh. So if you watch The Office, if Dwight says something absolutely insane, and then Jim goes like this, that's where everybody laughs. So by breaking the fourth wall, I was able to script reaction shots, as it were, into the book. So, you know, the statement might be, my head is made of blueberry pizza, but kids are actually laughing on, wait a second, because that's the reaction to the crazy thing. So breaking the fourth wall was essential here, I felt, to really get the laughs to pay off. Thank you for the great question.
Yeah, and one last thing. You were great on the Mindy Project.
Whoa, very sophisticated. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Next question also on this side.
How did you come up with the funny things like my head is made out of blueberry pizza?
Thank you very much. The funny things in the book, well, I guess there's two great levels on which I find that writing really flows. One is when you plan something. You have an original idea, and in that case, my original idea was a book with no pictures where the grown-up has to say silly things. Great, great idea. Let's sort of plan that out. How would that work? There should be a song. There should be funny syllables, that kind of thing. Then there's another type of writing called improvising, where you're not planning it, just whatever comes out of your mouth in that moment. And we actually did a lot of that on The Office, too. We would script a lot of scenes, but then one of the actors would just blurt something out in the moment that just felt right. And often that was even funnier than what we had planned, because when you're in that creative zone, a lot of improvising comes out, too. So I find the best way to do things is a combination of planning and improvising. So something like Blueberry Pizza, often the specifics of the book, I would just picture myself reading it to a kid, and just whatever popped out of my mouth was that phrase. So most of the individual phrases, my head is made of blueberry pizza, that was just improvising. And then I just wrote it down. Thank you for the question.
This is more of a comment. So going back to the first question that my younger sister asked, was it actually you had no pictures because you couldn't get an artist or you couldn't draw it?
Well, both options imply a failure on my end. You really didn't give me much room there. Could I not find an artist or could I not draw? Well, I will say that often creativity comes out of constraint. So it is true that I cannot draw. It is true that I did not have an artist ready to go. And perhaps that did influence me to think what I can do with text. I will say, though, that I also just have a love of the written word that I really wanted to promote. I have an Instagram. Do you know what Instagram is? Kind of. You're like, I invented Instagram. You're like, oh God, this lame old guy's still on Instagram. Doesn't even know about, Snapbot. So my Instagram, for example, which is a photo, it's meant for photographs, but it's called Pictures of Text. And all I do is take pictures of words. That's just who I am. I just love words. And for me, I spend more time choosing the sizes of the letters and the font of the letters and the colors and how, they played on the page. I spent more time doing that than I think a lot of people would spend choosing the pictures. So I would actually say that probably born out of the limitations that you so politely pointed out, I turned to strengths of mine and in areas of my own interest, which were text. Oh no, what else? He's got a follow-up.
Okay, that was a way better explanation than I had thought would come out.
Whoa! What a hater!
No, it's a compliment.
You should be a journalist. You really have a great skepticism of people in positions of power. Yes, sir. No, what's your follow-up?
Only the power of comedy.
Yes. But did you have a follow-up?
I had a follow-up. I really liked how you made the child seem like it was more in control in the book.
Yeah.
And how instead of just reading it to the mm-hmm. to the kid and being like, oh, wait, I didn't... It was you involving the person who you were reading it to.
Yeah, thank you. I thought one thing that a kid would especially appreciate is the line, is this whole book a trick? And that's sort of why the warning is on the back too. So a kid can feel that they made a decision to do this as opposed to just they're the beneficiary of a book that is on their side. I really like the idea that kids can see, even from a young age, that kids can see words as their allies, that they are on purpose teaming up with to explore cool stuff to do. Thank you.
What is your favorite book?
What is my favorite book? Well, one book that comes to mind is a book that I loved since I was your age, probably, and still love, It's by a guy named Shel Silverstein. I don't know if any kids here or adults know him. You know his work?
Yeah.
It's called Where the Sidewalk Ends.
I have that at my house.
Oh, great. Do you like it?
Yeah.
Excellent.
My mom bought it for me when my sister was born.
Oh, see, I cannot. This crowd is 10 steps ahead of me always. But I'd say that maybe is my favorite book in terms of it was my favorite book for so long because it was my favorite as a kid. And when I look through it now, I still love it. I like that it's very mischievous. And I like that you can flip through it and, you know, there's different lengths and stuff.
What's your favorite poem, though?
My favorite poem
In the Sidewalk Ends.
I think it's called Sick Day. Can I go to school today?
Yeah, it's just called Sick.
Sick, sorry. Oh, my God. I am getting torn apart by the children of San Francisco. This is the future right here.
Question over here.
Yes.
Why would you want the parents to say that?
Why would I want the parents to say that? Well, the real answer is that I love getting a laugh because I started out as a stand-up comedian and I still, most of the stuff I write has a lot of comedy to it and is usually just simply comedy. So I really wanted every grown-up to be able to get what I get when I read a funny book. And I wanted to write a funny book that I would be able to read and that all parents would be able to read. So I think when you kind of make fun of yourself in a very controlled way, it can get a great laugh. And I really just wanted all parents to be able to experience that without necessarily having to invent the book on their own. If they're tired at the end of the day and they just want something that they know will make a kid laugh, I thought, let's try to write something like that. Thank you. All and right. Last question.
Last question.
How did you come up with the idea of making the book?
Thank you so much for asking that question. Well, I come up with lots of ideas all the time. And can I ask you a question? Have you ever had an idea for a book? What's your idea for a book?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure? I get it. Often we have lots of ideas, right? But then we can't remember them when someone asks, right?
Yeah.
That happens to me all the time. So what I do is, are you able to write words yet or not yet? Not yet. When you are able to write words, instead of just remembering them, you can write down the word that you want to remember so that later when you look at the piece of paper, you're like, oh, right, that was my idea for a book. So that's what happened to me. I came up with this idea. I thought, oh, a book with no pictures to make kids laugh. I was reading it to my friend's son, and I thought of this idea because I thought, what would be the funniest book I could write? Then I wrote it down, the book with no pictures, and I forgot, just like you just forgot. And then 3 weeks later, I was looking through my notebook, and I saw the book with no pictures. That sounds like a hit. And so then I remembered it and wrote. But the thing is, I just have lots of ideas all the time, like you probably do, and I just write them down so I can remember them. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for coming. Thank you to all the kids. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. In the first half of the hour, our guest was San Francisco-raised, best-selling graphic novelist Raina Telgemeier, whose book is Share Your Smile, Raina's Guide to Telling Your Own Story. She was joined in conversation by NPR's Guy Raz. Then, in the second half of the hour, our guest was actor, comedian, screenwriter, and director BJ Novak, whose children's book is The Book with No Pictures. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.